Okay, so I've been studying cancer for like 4 or 5 years now, thanks to Larry et al. And I'm getting more and more depressed as time goes by. And I'll try to explain to you why I'm depressed. Of course, you've already seen this before. And of course, the basic problem is that the mortality rates are flat. And I would claim that the dip here is predominantly due to people smoking less and higher sanitation, giving rise to fewer antibiotic infections in the stomach and the decrease in stomach cancers. But basically, all the drops, I would say, are due to prevention, not due to our huge amount of work we put into the area of cancer treatment. And this is a very, really expensive stuff we're talking about here. $227 billion, major impact. So it's a big deal. And when you see this failure, it's not great. It's a big deal. So I'm going to start off by saying I could have the cancer rate tomorrow, and I could also put $100 billion into address the national deficit. And I could do it tomorrow. And I don't need physicists or biologists at all. The obvious thing I could do is cut down obesity. I guess like here they claim all of us dropped our BMI by 1%, which means we lose 2.2 pounds. We would avoid about 100,000 new cancers a year. Okay, so that's easy. Just go on a slight diet. The other thing is stop smoking. Cigarette consumption, lung cancer. Maybe people can see a correlation unless you're R.A. Fisher, who did not believe it, in case you didn't know that. So clearly, if Nixon had simply put a huge tax on cigarettes instead of declaring war on cancer, he would have close to have the cancer rate right there, and he would have put a huge amount of money into the treasury. It didn't happen. Fisher's an interesting character. You know, a lot of you guys use his statistics and stuff. He actually thought that people that smoked were genetically predisposed to get cancer, but there was no correlation between the two, and he could prove it. He was also paid by the tobacco companies to give these talks. So you can make of that what you want. I find it incredible. And here in California, you guys just recently rejected a $1 tax on cigarettes, which I think would probably resulted in probably 50,000 less cancer cases a year. And you want to blame Big Tobacco for that, because of course they fought it, mankind being what they are. But actually, I blame the Cancer Research Establishment, because the $1 billion windfall that you would have got from that tax, you wanted to put it into more cancer research. It's a huge mistake. Made it look like special interest pleading. Should have gone to the deficit. Boom, we would have done it. Didn't do it.
That's why I voted against.
Is that right? Fundamental mistake. I have a postdoc, a former postdoc, Juan Keimer. He's the guy that got me started in all this stuff. He's in Holland right now. He's a professor there. He's a smoker. I've been thinking about this. I emailed him last week. Juan, when are you going to stop smoking? It's stupid. His reply, stupid is good. You sound like Grandpa, dude. Okay. So none of these things are going to happen, all right? Just forget it, no matter how intelligent you are. And of course, the other thing is the way that the cancer rates. This is prostate. This is breast cancer. Different areas of the world. They change by factors of 20. I don't understand fully what's going on here. The madness begins here as to why this is true, but it's true. So you have to understand that cancer rates are vastly different in different areas of the world. It does not mean that in Eastern Asia that you better move there, because the prostate cancer rate is less than one-tenth what it is in Western Europe, because liver cancer rates are much higher, actually, because 40% of the population has hepatitis C. So it's not. These are just picked out, too. You can go to the database and look at your favorite cancer. And I don't want to get into that, because I don't know the answers. Anyways, we could clearly lower the cancer rate by at least 50% starting tomorrow. It isn't going to happen. It never will. So if you forget about human stupidity and greed, the question is, what's going on then? We outlawed that. So I think there's three drivers of cancer progression. And I think cancer progression predominantly occurs due to chemotherapy. That's my opinion. It's probably wrong. So I think the present paradigm, which started in around 1920, when they noticed that World War I soldiers that had been gassed in the trenches had their tumors shrink, mustard gas. And that started chemotherapy. And that was the beginning of the whole thing. But I think it fails, and it fails for three fundamental reasons. One is the genomic heterogeneity of a typical tumor, which is quite large. The longer it's been in your body, the more heterogeneous it is. The mutation rate enhancement under stress, predominantly due to chemotherapy. So most chemotherapies are mutagenic in nature, and they increase the mutation rates. And what you've done when you've done surgery and get chemo, you've broken your population down into a metapopulation, a weakly connected small population. So I would say that result is a foregone conclusion. You will get progression and metastasis because of that. And that's why it's failing. And will always fail and will continue to fail. So progression means this. You've seen this before. These are the famous Kaplan-Meier curves. What you're seeing here is the return of the cancer after some period of time, 50 weeks here in this case, or this particular one. This is a drug, which is a $1 billion seller. This is a placebo. They claim that it lengthens the survival by a factor of 2 at 25 weeks. But of course, everybody dies in the end. And it's what any oncologist deals with, rapid evolution. That's what's going on here. I don't want to dump on Big Pharma necessarily. This is the new chemistry building for Princeton. It's a $350 million building. It was paid for by the royalties that Princeton gets by Ted Theater's chemotherapy drug, which is for small lung cell lung cancer. We get $50 million a year from that drug. You really have to work at it to get at the Kaplan-Meier curves on drugs. You can go to the sites. If you work at it, you can get them. They pass around cookies for Alumni Day saying how fantastic this cancer drug is that Ted Taylor developed. It took 40 years to do that, and how it's a major breakthrough, just like the news that you saw on that cartoon the other day. This is the Kaplan-Meier curve, and this is the best one that I found of like 6 or 7 of them. This is their drug. This is the placebo. It's a failure, in my opinion. There may be some more survivals out here at the end if you were one of the lucky ones, but I would not exactly say this is a breakthrough. It's like all the other Kaplan-Meier curves I've seen. So I would buy Big Pharma stock, but I wouldn't buy what they say in the news all the time. One of the problems is that biologists get very defensive about Darwin. And the book was written over 100 years ago. There's nothing wrong with what Darwin said, but it's really a long time ago. And if you read Darwin's Descent of Man, you will find out there's no mathematics in it at all. Fisher and others developed neo-Darwinism in the 20th century, and basically the basic arguments are that successful mutations are random. This is obviously it's a random. Delta N equals S, the fitness advantage times the mutation rate times the number of individuals in the population. It's believed that the mutation rate is extremely low. And you've seen this number a lot here. One mutation per 10 to the 9th base pairs per replication. So this number is much less than one. And it's believed that we're fairly optimized. So that means that you're unlikely to increase, your fitness does not increase very much, S here. It's likely to be a number much less than one. So therefore, evolution proceeds extremely slowly, like erosion. And there's a problem with that because you just saw the Kaplan-Meier curves. It's not true, necessarily. So there's something fundamentally wrong is a strong word here, incomplete about what you're seeing here. Unfortunately, we don't do a good job of physics. At least most biophysics textbooks don't really get past this, F equals MA dV/dt. And I know this is hard. It's a total derivative velocity of time. Fisher, who is one of the fathers of evolution theory, has a fundamental equation of evolution. The change in fitness with time Of course, it's proportional to the variance of the genome. If you have no variance in the genome, how could you possibly evolve? And then there's a mutation rate, which presumably moves you out of that sort of thing. This is Fisher's fundamental equation of evolution. Unfortunately, Fisher was an extremely stubborn man. He got into a big fight with Sewell Wright, who's one of my heroes. I think he's one of the few honest people in this gang here, actually. Wright had a deeper way to view what was going on here in the system. And Wright emphasized the importance of the number of individuals in the population. Fisher was of the belief that the number of individuals in the biological population was always so large that that effect was not important. But I don't think that's true. And I think actually the number of individuals makes a large difference in the how quickly you can actually evolve and adapt. Boris, if you're awake, and go back to sleep. He doesn't like this too much, I think, but this is his famous hand-drawn curves from Wright's paper. He didn't use a computer at all. And the only point here is that if you have a product of the number of individuals and the mutation rate, this is sort of a medium range here, not too extremes. You end up with a large variance in the genome when that happens. And of course, you want variances in order to get that evolution. The point is that Wright stressed that it's not only you, but also N that matters here in this case. And if you have an intermediate-sized population and sort of a master equation approach came down, then you end up with this variance here. And Wright really emphasized that in his work.
Why doesn't Boris like that?
Say again?
Why doesn't Boris like that plot?
I think Boris likes it. Was Boris gone, Hope?
He, there was a call, I think he went.
Oh, good, 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 good. I can hear all sorts of terrible things about Boris.
Time did, right?
You'll never know. Anyway, just pick a few lines here. And this is very technical, by the way, and there's lots of arguments about this. I'm just copying some pages of a really great student right now who's getting his thesis written up, and I was reviewing his thing. And I just thought I'd just copy out from his thesis a few of these fundamental equations that sort of determine what's going on here. So this is complicated stuff. This is a backward Kolmogorov equation, some kind of also associated with Fisher. And basically what you're looking at here is you have some frequency of gene P at time zero. And the question is, what's the probability of having a frequency Q at times T? And that's a function of the growth of the population versus time. So there's a logistics growth right here. And the fitness determines how fast you grow. So this should make some sense here. And then there's sort of a master equation diffusional thing here where you have mutations into and out of that state. And the variances in that get scaled in by the size of the population. Okay. This is called the backward Kolmogorov equation. And you can, a nice place to read up about this is Biological Evolution and Statistical Physics by Barbara Grossel. I really like her article a lot. And this is sort of the fundamental equation one is working with. I'm a knuckle-dragging experimentalist, by the way, so I'm not going to claim that I'm a master on this. But you can go and look at the equilibrium. It's a time-dependent equation. But you can go and set the time derivative on the left-hand side equal to zero, and you can find out that the probability to fix a particular genome, which has a fitness S, if you have a population of individuals N, it becomes dependent upon the number of individuals. And this is the equation one derives here. S is the fitness, and N is the number of individuals. So obviously, as the number of individuals gets very large, the probability for fixation no longer depends on the number of individuals in that population. Sort of falls off exponentially here at large N. But as the number of individuals decreases, now the probability for fixation becomes a function of the fitness and the number of individuals. So it goes from a straight line. Obviously, if you're not very fit, you have a very low probability to fix it. If you're very fit, you have a very high probability of fixing. But it doesn't depend upon how many individuals in that population. That's Fisher. Wright looked into this area here, and then you realize that it then becomes a function of the number of individuals in the population because of the variances that are occurring due to the finite number of people going on. Does that mean that small n simply widens the heterogeneity of the population? That's right, it does. So when you have small n, you have a more heterogeneous population. That's right to say. And it's an important point. It drives evolution forward from fundamental theorems of evolution. But I think also, fortunately Boris is not here, small n also gives increasing weight to the less fit things. If you look at the rate at which the probability for fixation changes with the size of the population, just take the derivative of this, and assume that S is much less than 1, and Sn is much less than 1. You simply get this equation right here, 1 over S times N. So for a given fitness, S, if the population is small, you have a higher probability of fixing in that population than if N is large. Okay? So population size does, of course, matter, and it tends to favor the less fit ones as the population size gets smaller. You guys buy that?
But you're missing.
Nobody wants to fight on this.
You're missing. There's another effect here.
There's plenty of effects.
Which the larger the population is, the more birth events you have, and therefore the speed of evolution also depends on n because of
the time. All the fix also scales with the number of people too, right? So there's a time-dependent equation here in this thing here. So you can look at this. Okay. So the time to fix scales with log of n, basically. So for a given fitness n, if you have a large population n, it takes longer to fix than you have a small population. So there's both a time dependence to fixation time, and there's also a probability dependence. Okay? And this is basically school of life. Or say worship. He always, anyways, he's not here. It's great. So I can just do some simple numbers, like for bacteria, four million base pairs. And let's suppose that a single SNP could give rise to resistance to an antibiotic. It's not true, by the way, but just imagine that's true. Then if this rate is only one mutation per 10 to minus 9 base pairs per generation, if you have 1,000 bacteria, okay, only one of them has a mutation somewhere in the genome, right? And if the thing is going to have to search through 4 million of them to find the magic one, it's going to take an incredibly long time for that to happen. It basically won't happen. But on the other hand, you can have lots of bacteria, right? So you can get a billion bacteria quite easily. And in a billion bacteria in one generation, one of them is going to have the magic mutation with high fitness. The trouble is that the probability for that guy to fix in that population is extremely small because n here is 10 to the 9. So that's unlikely to happen. And also it's going to take a very long time to do that. So that means most biologists then believe that if you're going to do evolution experiments, you have to use large buckets. You have to have liters of stuff and wait 20 years. Okay? But that's because they're using well-mixed tubes, test tubes. They shouldn't be doing that. They should break it down into small populations and put stress gradients on. And that's an idea that's been around for a while, as I mentioned. It's known to occur for HIV, for instance. And Terry Waugh, my friend at UCSD, one of the few remaining physicists at UCSD, has actually been working on this theoretically with Rucker Hermson, had several papers on the subject, so I'm not making it up. Anyways, the idea is, in fact, if you follow these rules, I would call them physics rules, you can greatly accelerate evolution if you do that. Stop doing large test tubes. It's just stupid, you know. Go to very small things. So as I was on sabbatical in Hong Kong at the time, and actually we were doing these workshops with the NCI that Larry told you about the other day, and all this stuff catalyzed me to start thinking about this stuff and what I could do. And I realized, well, geez, why don't I listen to what Wright was saying and make a population of lots of small metapopulations and put stress and a gradient across a thing and let them move from place to place. And this should vastly accelerate evolution if these ideas are right. So it's an experimental test. It either is going to work or it's not going to work. So I did it. And there's this thing called Goldilocks point. You can do it. There's a lot of really interesting mathematics here that's involved. But basically, the idea is to get a mutation. If you can move to another place where you have a very small number of individuals, you can rapidly fix in that place there, and you can move to there and blah, 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 blah. That's the basic idea. You can do all sorts of modeling and things like that. But that's the fundamental idea. I mean, there should be certain hotspots where this rapid ignition of evolution of resistance, in this case here to antibiotics, should work. So here's my movie that we did a couple years ago. We put 1 million bacteria in this thing, and there's a mutagenic antibiotic here along this side, Cipro. It's one of the few antibiotics that still works. And this LB broth along here. Prediction was we should see ignition of evolution, resistance to the Cipro over in these one of these two points here. And that does happen after 3 hours. This is in hours, not days or years or millennia. And after about 5 or 6 hours, which actually was happening here, you can't see because of the light on the screen, that these things actually spread around the perimeter of this thing. And after around 10 hours, we ended up having bacteria which were resistant to times 200, the normal minimum inhibitory dose, in 10 hours. So the whole damn thing worked. Which is still shocking to me that it works, by the way.
What's special about the perimeter?
Say again?
What's special about the perimeter?
What's special about the perimeter? Very good question. What's special about the perimeter is you have to put stress on these things, and I want the bacteria to move around on their own volition. So I didn't show you the technology here. The food and antibiotics come in through nano slits, so it's diffusively coupled into the thing. And because it's diffusively coupled in, the bacteria, because of their high metabolic rates, really come over the edge here. It's like California, right? And so they all grow along the perimeter, because that's the only place the food is at. Okay? So it's something the engineers are really irritated by, because it's an open loop experiment. I let the bacteria decide what they're going to do. I don't make those decisions for them. Which I think is what you should really do. Remember, Roger Bacon never did an experiment in his life. And what's going on here is that the bacteria under stress, Cipro is a topoisomerase. It runs DNA through itself in order to allow the supercoils of a replicated genome chromosome of the bacteria to occur. It starts, blocks that, and you start spinning off single-stranded DNA when Cipro binds and stalled forks. And what the bacteria try to do is they sort of make an attempt to fix these things if they possibly can. But if too much single-stranded DNA builds up, the RecA builds up on the single-stranded DNA, and you move over to another point of this network, which is called the SOS response. And that results in some genes being turned on. The most interesting one is POL5, which is an error-prone polymerase, which is simply will go through stalled forks and it won't try to make them match up. It's very mutagenic. The mutation rates under Cipro at the MIC are about 10,000 times higher than that 10 to the minus 9. 10 to the minus 9 is not Planck's constant. It's a completely number which is determined by the organism to play around with it as it sees fit. And that's what happens. And there's a nice mathematical analysis you can do with this network. But what's going on here is this POL5 is now making error-prone polymerases mutagenic, and the system ends up making gyrase A, that's where Cipro binds, which are now not affected by Cipro. And I won't go off of the details. I have other fish to fry here today. But you really, you can fight if you want, but you really need this Death Galaxy topology to do that. I always have biologists say, well, this will work, and it never happens. You really need this design. You need spatial gradients and organization utility. And to try to get in fights with my biology friends, it's de novo. These are not pre-existing mutations that are already there. How do I know that? Well, we can go ahead and do an experiment with 100 bacteria. I made some comment here about E.F. Delbruck. I keep on trying to put the stake through Delbruck because he's convinced all the biologists that all mutations are pre-existing, right? Because that's this famous Delbruck-Lurie experiment. And they're just completely indoctrinated in this thing, including the physicists, by the way. But that's not true. Because the phage experiment was a lethal experiment. In other words, you get phage infection. It kills the bacteria. There's no evolution possible in the experiment. The only result in that experiment that you could have seen was that there were pre-existing, which is, that's all that could have happened in the Delbert-Lurie experiment. Because the phage kills the bacteria. SIBO doesn't kill the bacteria. They are zombies. They are Catholic priests. They can't reproduce. But they're fully alive and living. And they simply go to a place where they can slowly replicate. That doesn't happen in the Delbert-Lurie scenario. I'm not contradicting Delbert-Lurie at all. It's just irrelevant to what we're doing here. Buy that?
But if SIBO binds gyrase A.
Say again?
SIBO binds gyrase A, right?
Gyrase A.
And that should really kill bacteria.
Say again?
That should end up killing bacterial
cells. It doesn't kill them. That they can't reproduce. They will live a long time, and they're Catholic priests. They'll live a long, full life. They just don't create any progeny. It's not bactericidal. It's bacteriostatic, right? A fundamental difference. The fundamental difference.
Can it accumulate mutations?
Say again?
Can it accumulate mutations in the process?
Or so then, no. I just wanted to try to drive a stake through Delbert's heart, but I can't do it. There's no way to kill the beast. I can't do it. But you can do experiments. You can put 100 bacteria in. And I think this is probably, I have to start this thing quick. Starting. There. You can't see 100 bacteria in here, but 100 bacteria put in, trust me. Right? And so before with a million, you saw the eruption of evolution of resistance in around 3 hours. But I only have 100 bacteria here. Now, if they're pre-existing ones, and it only comes from pre-existing, it'll never happen. This thing will take life forever. Okay? But if it's de novo, then the system is under stress, it's turned on the SOS response, Pol Pot has been turned on, it's starting to work its way through things by whatever means possible. It's just a matter of time while we have to wait under these high stress conditions over this thing. It's going to start with very few bacteria. There's going to be a slow growth over here. It's bacteriostatic, not bactericidal. Okay. And if we just wait long enough, eventually the bacteria will find the key, and you should start to see, and it should sort of go with the law of the number of bacteria. You saw that equation there.
I'm getting confused while the bacteria is coming up.
Say again?
I'm getting confused while the bacteria is coming up. Beautiful. But you explained all the...
You see all the action here, guys. Okay.
No,
all right. But after 25 hours, it happens. Okay, go ahead.
Wow, beautiful. Okay. So the thing is that the fixation probability and the NNS that you explained, a key thing in that dynamics is that numbers getting replaced and numbers staying fixed and somebody dying off while other...
No, it's not bactericidal again. Remember this...
No, I understand. Yeah. That's precisely my question. The theory you showed...
Yeah.
Has random death of some things and replacement by others. If nobody is actually reproducing till everything is ready with proper gyrase mutation, mm-hmm. right?
Not necessarily death there, by the way. Side bactericidal.
Right, but if I believe bacteriostatic, okay, so are you trying to say that when the final plowing over happens, there is some reproduction? And that's what I should think about.
Well, listen, so the idea behind this whole device is there's always reproduction on the device somewhere. Somewhere at night, somebody is copulating, all right? Up here in this area here, there's some Democrats, all right? It's happening, but very slowly, okay? Very slowly. This is 200 times the mic up here. Up here, it's like at the mic.
Okay, no. Okay. So the point is that there is some reproduction.
There is some reproduction going on.
At a lower.
The thing is struggling along, right? In an error-prone way, is what's happening. And eventually, after around 25 hours there, you saw that the system then, once again, evolved resistance. And now, actually, because it took longer, by the way, I don't know, we have sequenced these. These guys are actually fit over the entire device, by the way. And the other ones are sort of, you know, they only lived along the coast. These guys went into into the Central Valley.
Could we see the video again in the sense, where does it actually start? Where the first few
seconds?
Which part of your...
They were put it in the center here. They started here.
No, but where do you get the first meet? Which part of the...
I don't know. I can't see that. There's only 100 of them.
But you still see them somewhere growing, the patch.
Yeah, yeah, you saw them. But by the time you start to merge here, there's hundreds of thousands of bacteria. With this camera that we're running.
But you still expect that the first mutation might have happened somewhere there, right?
I don't know. It's probably, you know, stochastic. You know, it's somewhere in this region here. But remember, they're motile, and this is they swim. If you put a lot of Cipro in your bacteria, you can't tell you put it in. They're swimming around. Ta-da! They're happy.
But if you repeat the experiment, it's a random spot where things emerge out, right?
Say again?
If you repeat the experiment because of the randomness, right, it would start from different...
Yeah, that's right. That's right, Larry. Every time I do the experiment, the pattern is different. That's different. By the waves are cool. Now, you can actually get even more formal here from the Fisher Cromwell. Now you can actually worry now about the dynamics. You saw that equation before. These are the wild type and the mutants, and they're interacting with one another. And this thing has wave-like solutions, the solitons, some sort of speeds. And those waves you saw, they were presumably some sort of evolutionary waves moving over this landscape. Now, there's a lot of math you can do in this stuff. So it's complex what I'm doing here. But what I'm trying to tell you, like special relativity, actually you'll find that maybe the bacteria came up with quite an elegant solution to this problem. So what happened? So what you have to do then is sequence. And because of the Physical Science Ecology Center program and the way Thea Tilstey helped me set it up, we have a core sequencing facility at UC Santa Cruz, which is really quite fantastic, run by Nanda Kumar. And so because we had easy access to this and then the fantastic people there, John Kim is a grad student there, which is just really incredible, we were able to take these bacteria and do a replica plate, pick a colony, send it to Nader and UCS and sequence them. And so that's been done, of course. And we're very selective here. If you know about sequencing, you don't have seen this is two different experiments. There's a SNP right here that occurs at this location right here. And I'm not showing the full depth. We didn't accept any SNPs that are under times 50 deep, so we're really very demanding. Here's an experiment repeated here. Here's the wild types. You're going to have to believe me that these SNPs are hard called. We're really demanding on our SNP calls. And so that's we're careful about that. And it took a long time to figure that out. It's not trivial. But anyways, what happens here is that the system comes up with exactly four SNPs. And a little bit along the lines that Larry is asking here, this is a separate experiment. Here's an experiment, here's an experiment, here's an experiment. We're showing, I guess it's three here, but we did nine of them. It got too complicated. It always comes up with exactly the same solution. You always get the same four SNPs. Every time.
If you ever put these guys back with the normal population under no stress, are they...
Nothing happens. No stress.
Without stress, they actually get disappeared.
Yeah, nothing happens in Santa Barbara. Right. People don't get better. Got to go to Chicago.
No, I mean that, are they outcompeted by the wild type?
What are you asking? Oh, you mean mix the two together?
Yeah, and no stress.
Oh, no, that's a very interesting question. These things are almost as fit as wild type. If you run the growth curves on them, they're only slightly less fit. Okay. So they coexist, actually. These are not like really strange mutants that can barely survive. They have almost the same fitness as the wild type. And we're doing those experiments, as a matter of fact. So can, and the answer is they live together. These are not a lot less fit, but they are enormously more fit in the presence of Cipro, of course. So but under all the broad conditions, you have a hard time telling them apart. Like you can't, basically.
First, the Delbrook's ghost comes back and then would have asked that why are they not there in the regular population?
I'm sorry. What was that?
I guess Delbrook's ghost then would come and ask you.
Right, I killed him, didn't I? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say.
All right, let's say. So how's this ghost going to come back?
Well, that part I don't know, but suppose he comes back.
Okay, sure. All right. So Dahlberg's back.
Right. So okay. You would end up asking then, why are those mutants not pre-existing in the population? because they don't have much of a fitness cost.
They don't have much of a fitness cost, right. There might be, yes, they don't have much of a fitness cost, right, as far as we can tell.
Okay, but normally you don't see them.
We don't. But I'm just, you're right. If they were really a lot less fit, I would say there's just no way. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good point, right. Anyways, if you go ahead and do this, the sequencing, right, you find that what happens is like it binds to gyrase A. Indeed, in fact, at this position, 2337183, the mutation is from it's a missense, so it means it changed the amino acid from aspartic acid to glycine. Glycine just has a hydrogen, aspartic acid is an acidic group like that. So that makes sense. In other words, it's on the gyrase A gene, and it makes a bulky group less bulky and less acidic. That's that baby right here. And now we show 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 experiments, always the same. The 7 significant figures, right? And I'll show what this looks like. It's very beautiful. So John went ahead and, fortunately, because we have the, not only the E. coli, this is Cipro, annotated, we also have X-ray crystal structures of gyrase A and the bound to DNA. So we can actually, there's a DNA, so it tries to move it through, but Cipro binds, and that's the basic blocking mechanism there. This is gyrase A, and this is where our SNP is. Once it stops spinning, it's right here, right where the Cipro is binding to the DNA. It's right there. So it makes sense this is a fully functional SNP. Don't ask me how that works. So I could spend the rest of my life doing that if I was a true biophysicist writing in the biophysical journal. But I got bigger fish to fry than that. I'm just telling you that it makes sense. And that's good enough for me. We found other SNPs. There's 4 of them. There is also, and that's known, by the way, you rarely, one SNP does not a phenotype make. We also found SNPs, these other ones were right here. It's in pumps. So the bacteria try to pump out these antibiotics. What I'm just showing here, by the way, is another experiment I haven't published yet, that these pumps are actually right at the origin of replication. And in 20 minutes, the thing actually starts making multiple copies of the pumps. So it's trying to get the antibiotic out. And so that's it's quite amazing, actually. That's the pumps are actually located on the genome where you need to get the thing rolling. And so we see multiple copies appearing in 20 minutes. And it's on an hour's scale, it starts to mutate them. So it's quite a program running, actually. It's pretty interesting. And then we also found 2 SNPs in the MAR operon. The MAR operon is a operon associated with generalized antibiotic resistance. So it all makes sense. There's a problem. There's no passengers. Where are the passengers? You'd expect the things doing these random mutations. That's a little bit, this is a hard question to answer. Of course, I have to tell you, we put a huge stress on these things. The fitness landscape here is extraordinarily steep. So passengers just aren't going to survive in this kind of environment. You either make something that works and you fix, or you don't and you don't. So it does not have a flat fitness landscape, but it's very, very steep, like the Sierra Nevadas. It's a very steep one. I'm not too surprised with some general calculations, we don't see a background of passengers jumping around, but we don't. That's just the facts. Some people are troubled by that. But it's fairly shocking that you see this rapid and innovative finding of the ways to bypass the antibiotics in a few hours. And highly specific places that are highly functional, and they're pretty clever. We didn't anticipate the pumps being changed. Right? We weren't looking for that. So I would say the system knows what it's doing, which is a heretical statement to make. I don't think it's a random process at all. Okay, well, but I got bigger fish to fry. I could spend the rest of my life studying this. Larry wants me to do something for cancer. So, well, we better put cancer cells in this thing. So that's what we're doing. The question, of course, does this work for cancer cells? The same idea. Break the population into a metapopulation of small numbers, put a high stress gradient on them. Does that accelerate evolutionary resistance in cancer? Because that's ultimately, that's half of what kills you is the is procession progression. Okay, and I would say, in fact, that the core of our present paradigm of chemotherapy is, you know, to do surgery and then do chemo. And what I'm claiming is now that I should have tried to convince you it's doomed to fail. It doomed to fail. Okay, when will we accept that failure? Never. As Max Planck said, science advances one funeral at a time. We're not going to do that till the generation of people that got chemotherapy die out and some younger people rethink things. That's when it will happen, my prediction. So I just thought I'd put in a little ad here that the NCI supported something which bacterial evolution of antibody. What the hell has that to do with cancer, you idiots? You know, but actually it's the core of what's going on. And so once we had that under our belts, then we moved over to this. And the people, I want to stress to you how multidisciplinary the team then becomes at this point. Like Amy is in the electrical engineering department. Aristo is in at the Moffitt Cancer Institute. Bob Gattenby, bioengineering that's in Nader. Who's this? Biology New NYU. Oh, that's Guillaume. Like, he moved there from the physics department. So this is a very interdisciplinary thing you're seeing here now is going on. None of this would have happened without the inside PSLCs, I'm sure. Because every time I go to the NSF or something like that with some of this, I absolutely get turned down. And they say, this is crazy, you can't do this. And if you're going to do it, you have to have a biologist to make you think straight. And I avoid that at all costs. So I'm going to tell you about this one experiment, multiple myeloma, not melanoma, skin cancer. It comes from the Greek for bone marrow. It's a cancer of plasma cells. These are cells that produce antibodies in your immune system. And when you develop a multiple myeloma, these abnormal plasma cells accumulate in the bone marrow. Of course, the bone marrow stores the B lymphocytes is the origin of these things. And when you get this cancer developing, it appears first in your bone marrow. Since it's involved with plasma cells, you get antibodies being developed, which are abnormal, and they cause all sorts of kidney problems as well as associated with it. The first symptoms are usually pain in your bones because you form these lesions where the bone has actually been eaten away by the cancer. And that's the name for multiple myeloma. Multiple means you have multiple places where the bone is being eaten away. It's an extremely painful condition. It's generally thought it is, in fact, treatable but incurable. What do they mean by that? Well, it's always treatable because they can always give you chemo, right? But it always progresses. It's almost invariably lethal. It always progresses, although there's some progress on it. But you don't want to get multiple myeloma. It's typically an old man's disease. Your 70s appears. Maybe Daryl can understand that. So the idea is, here's my basic idea. The same thing you saw in my Death Galaxy is presumably happening in the bone marrow. A highly structured environment, very heterogeneous, a lot of little local places for the thing. This is the kind of thing where you kind of see that sort of happening. So I would say that what we designed here for the bacteria is related to what goes on in cancers after the surgery has been done. They've gone ahead and generated these things right here. And then they go ahead and put stress on them. So because the engineers were uncomfortable with the Death Galaxy, because they didn't have enough control of the parameters, they forced me to make Alcatraz, which is the death row. Which simply means instead of making this hexagonal thing, we still have the hexagons, the cells can move back and forth, but it's a line of them. And the we run a chemotherapy on the top and none at the bottom. You can see the fluorescent trait here again in the gradient of the chemotherapy. We allow the cells to move around the place. The same basic idea. Everything had to be rescaled and everything like that for cancer cells as opposed to bacteria, but it's the same basic idea. Okay? Now, we actually have two experiments running right now. The other one's on neuroblastomas, which is also showing similar results, but this one's more advanced because the neuroblastoma one's being done in Korea. It's more complicated than the bacteria. The cancer cells are actually pretty fragile. They're screwed up. These multiple myeloma cells were from a male, as you'll see in a second, and he had already, I assume he died because he already had some resistance to chemotherapy. I assume that guy was died. And anyway, say at the Moffitt Center, they have developed this cell line of myelomas, but they can't live by themselves. They also have to have the cells that are in the marrow. These are called stromal cells. You've heard that term a lot here, I'm sure. And so it took Amy a long time to figure out how to culture multiple myeloma cancer cells in Alcatraz, and we found we had to have coexisting in this culture stroma cells too. And so they're green, and the GFP and the myelomas are red. So she figured all this stuff out. It took over a year to figure it out and get it to work. It's a huge amount of work. We went after doxorubicin. Doxorubicin is it's a chemotherapy agent still used. Cipro, it interculates in between DNA breaks like that. So it acts a lot like Cipro, and it's a mutagenic chemotherapy agent. And the question is that if we put a gradient of doxorubicin across this thing and we culture the things, do we see the rapid emergence of resistance to doxorubicin in a period of a couple weeks? Prediction is we should. So I think this movie should run. There it goes. So we have two color channels here. We have there's a gradient here of doxorubicin. 200 nanomolar is a huge amount of doxorubicin, by the way. Typically, the doses are probably as delivered is on the order of 20 nanomolar or so. So the cancer cells glow in red here, and the stromal cells glow in green. And so what you're seeing here is over a period. They're sort of running by themselves. Let's look at the myeloma cells. So that's running. So that's days, right? They start to grow. Of course, they get affected by the doxorubicin. But at the end of this several days of time, at a couple weeks, there's actually a few myeloma cells which are actually growing up here at extraordinarily high doxorubicin concentrations. And these are the stromal cells which are co-evolving with the doxorubicin, with the myeloma cells. So the bottom line here is we do see growth of the cells. We see both. And it's interesting, what you see here is now this is what happens. And after day 8, you'll see that the stromal cells sort of get away from the doxorubicin. But up here, there are resistant multiple myeloma cells. They're growing at much higher concentrations of doxorubicin than could be possibly tolerated by a person. So these cells, presumably up here in this region here after 8 days, have become extraordinarily resistant to doxorubicin. And you can plot here, this is the viability versus doxorubicin. This is a wild type here. These guys are already resistant, right? These are cancer cells from a patient who died after chemotherapy. What we've done is boosted it up by another factor of 20, basically. These cells here are now able to grow at close to micromolar concentrations of doxorubicin, about a factor of 20 going up from already resistant. So these guys have moved from a resistant state to a super resistant state.
And the non-resistant?
Questions.
Yeah, how would the curve look like for non-resistant?
I'm sorry.
For the non-resistant cells, do you have a...
They're resistant. They're already resistant.
You don't have a curve for the non-resistant.
Say again?
You don't have a curve for the non-resistant. So how much is the change before in the patient?
Yeah, so I'm not sure what church you're asking. So we got these cells from Moffitt.
He says, can you guess what the original curve
is? What would be the original
curve for that? It'd be around a nanomolar or so, right around here, somewhere around here. This would be a really, if you just got cells from the bone marrow and incubated them versus doxorubicin, a couple nanomolars enough to kill them. These are cancer cells that came from the patient who died. They're already resistant. And we booted the resistance up higher.
So I guess the interesting question might be whether it would be as rapid a process to evolve from one nanomolar to...
I don't know. Right.
To 100 nanomolar.
Yeah, I think one of the big mistakes in my program is that we should be not working with cancer cells, right? In some respects, I'm beating a dead horse. We already know that cancer cells become resistant. I'm showing how to make it happen fast, which we know happens in the human body, okay? What I really should be doing is starting out with truly naive cells and see this first transition. But there's more to this than meets the eye. You know. But you're right, Boris, and we've not done that, and we should be doing that. Unfortunately, maybe some of the cell exercise that we did at PSOC was with cancer cells. We should not have done that. The third line should have been normal cells. Yeah, I understand your point. It's a very good point. It's a failing. Anyways, but these have become super resistant. They're super cells. We know a couple things about them. Well, we know the pumps have changed. Just like in the bacteria, what you can do is you can put in a dye and watch the concentration of the dye in the cell. So these resistant cells have pumps that are running, of course, but they're not particularly effective for this particular dye we have. The ones that have evolved, which we can culture, are much more effective at pumping out things. So we know that the pumps have changed in the super resistant cells. This seems to be always on the first lines of defense that a cancer cell will do.
Is it mutation or is it just...
Don't know. Okay. We do not see, I'm going to show you the sequence in a second, we don't see mutations in the pumps, but I'm going to qualify that because I don't swear to that, okay?
But there is no indication of copy number change.
No, we don't know. We don't know. There's like a fivefold increase in the pumping ability. Whether it simply made multiple copies, whether the network is, I don't know. All I know is, in fact, they are more effective at pumping out the chemo.
But you think it's the same number of proteins?
Say again?
Looks like you have more protein there.
What are you looking at?
Found by Western blot. The right hand bottom.
The right hand.
Or Western.
Down here, yeah, the Western blot. Right. We did Western blot.
More proteins, but I think whether it's due to expression.
Right. Exactly right. I don't know. There's of course there's more of you. Absolutely right. Whether as to the expression levels have changed, copy whatever. I'm not making any claims for that at all.
That's all.
I'm just saying that it did change the pumps. In whatever way, I don't know. What about the genetic changes, right? How much evolution occurred in 2 weeks? Is the solution elegant or compact, or is it a mess? Right? What happens? Now I have to tell you now, this is, so we've been bashing on this. It's hot off my RAID servers. I've been sitting there going back and forth with my students. It takes over a solid, what we've done here is 400 million Illumina reads. You know, this is now not this is not Kansas anymore. This isn't 4 million bases, it's gigabases. So it's a much bigger problem. So we've been working on we have multiple groups doing sequence alignment of this stuff. Chrisanne and Amy at Princeton, and they were working with the guys at Santa Cruz. We got terabytes of data flowing back and forth in my servers. These guys are really good, and the sequencing core now is really really earning their pay here. I should warn you, when you hear this talk about a $1,000 genome, just walk away from that. That's just garbage, right? This is tough business here. Do you believe these things or not is a hard thing. So what we've sequenced here is not whole genome, of course. It's the messenger RNA we're sequencing. So we're looking at the exons, okay, in two cell lines. The wild type multiple myeloma cells, which are already resistant, and the cancer cells after 2 weeks. And the only thing we can compare them to, unfortunately, is the human genome that gets published on the web. We're down to session 37 right now. So that's what we're comparing it to. There's a generic 37 one. There is these cancer cells before they get in the chip, and there's ones after. Three cell lines. One of them we don't sequence, two of them we obviously do. So we have 400 million reads, about 50 pastures long from Illumina, and we're mapping it to the Homo sapiens guide number 37. So I'm learning all this stuff. Like Boris is really good at this now too. I know. So I just give you a note of vicious reality here. If you go ahead and just look at the multiple melanoma cells before they come in, they are already somewhat resistant. If you compare that to the human genome 37, there's 1,200 SNPs that come up. Okay? And that's not counting genomic. If you look at the ones after 2 weeks, 2,400 SNPs. All right? Now, be careful. What's a SNP, right? You're trying, you have only these 50 base pairs, and you have Craig Venter, they were trying to align this whole thing, right? There's lots of ways to screw up. There's infinite number of ways to screw up. So whether you believe, these are not real numbers. These are just, you know, something that comes off the start. Anyways, it should be 1,300 there. The problem is the coverage is also not uniform. It's, and this is the best in the game, right? In other words, we will have, give me an example, what am I trying to say here? We don't have coverage on the same sites. We might have great coverage for a potential SNP on the wild type. Then we look at the same place on the mutant, and its coverage is very poor. Can't make a call, right? You can't make calls if you don't have good coverage on both sites. It's a big problem. Right, so it's not, you have to do all this filtering and stuff, it's extremely subjective. I'm just telling you the truth here. So when you try to go for SNP calls where you have good coverage on both of them, you're left with around 255. Where we have good coverage on both sites, and we can maybe compare the two. Most of these don't map the known genes, by the way. You go ahead and take a look at that. But whatever that means, they could be passengers. Now here's our 23 chromosomes. This is the SNP call compared to the 37 with decent coverage for the wild type. This is the mutant. This guy was indeed a man. He has XY chromosome. There it is. Isn't that cool? That's so cool. Right? He was a man. I was looking, what the hell? Why is this one here so long in here? Oh yeah, as a man, he's got a useless Y. Okay, these red dots here are SNPs compared to human 37 that are common to both the two strand, the wild type and the thing. So obviously, even though they're called as SNPs, they also appear here, so nothing happened there. All the rest of these blue guys don't overlap. They don't overlap. That's a problem, right? That's an interesting problem. So then the coverage is varying. And the order, we demanded times 20 coverage to call a SNP here. But there's a lot of mutations going on here, Daryl. Daryl, there's a lot of mutations going on here. I'm warning you this in a couple weeks. So Daryl, I don't buy that evolution proceeds slowly in a tumor. I'm not going to buy that. Maybe it's some, but this is pretty dramatic what you're seeing here. If it did, we could cure cancer. But actually what happens is it's a game of whack-a-mole. This thing's coming up all the time. You ask Steve Jobs, he's in heaven now. I like this cartoon because I'm a Buddhist, as you guys all know. Hey, it's Steve Jobs. Welcome to iCloud, buddy. Mind if I check you in my iPad? Cute, look, I'm a Buddhist, all right? I think it's kind of funny. Anyways, but I think actually there's a lot of stuff going on in this thing. A lot of stuff. And it's de novo. It's not pre-existing. All right. So what's going on here? And it's worse than you think, Boris. I got an email from my, I have a really smart grad student. They want to mess with smart people, right? They fight you every step of the way. So we've had two successive works passes on SNPs. I thought we settled it down. I get an email this morning from Chris Ennis. Previously, we used a new version of SAM tools on, you guys know this stuff, VCF is a common gene sequencing package. Well, Chris Ann, who's really smart, has decided it's all bullshit. He doesn't trust any packaged sequence analysis stuff. So the past week, he's written his own SNP call code, right, which he's capable of doing, and he has his own set of SNP calls, which are different than the ones I'm going to show you, okay? I'm just telling you how subjective this is, and if you rely upon black box SNP calls by some protege of R.A. Fisher, watch out. You don't know what's there, right? It could be garbage, and I don't know. But I think he's gone off the deep end here on this one. And anyways, he went ahead and did this. I'm not going to go over what he found, because I don't get it. I'm fighting with him on that.
Okay.
He won't get his PhD.
but this set is of roughly similar number, mostly non-overlapping.
His call and completely different.
Okay.
I'm being as honest as I can with you guys.
So let me ask you. So you're looking for just fixed SNPs, right? You're looking for fixed mutations.
Yeah, of course. That's what you see when you sequence. Right. You're seeing fixed SNPs.
Yeah. Depends on coverage.
By definition, I mean. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you what comes out of the commercial package. Right, we find five that we trust, which is a big cut down. But I'm just telling you, we're just being really tough on the SNP calls. And there they are. This is the chromosome number. These are right next to one another on chromosome 17, one on 2, one on 15, one at 6. There's location. Now we're going to 6, 7, 8 significant figures. Right, it's kind of cool. And the human genome is annotated, right? So we know this is the name of the gene associated with these five SNPs. And the coverage levels, we were tough. 74, 65, 59, 64. So that's the best we could do. Good coverage on both of them. That's the best we could do.
What's your typical coverage?
Say again?
What's your typical coverage?
There is no typical number. I could give you the average is around 30, and the variance is probably that big. If I was giving you a coverage map, it's all over the place.
So this is nearly the big, a lot.
It's at the high end, right. This is as conservative as I can be. Okay. I can give you many hundreds more SNPs if you want, but I wouldn't base any chemotherapy on that, because I think you're going to die if they do that to you. Okay? And he thinks it's bullshit, but I think he's wrong. We'll find out. We have a lot of conference calls next week.
That's a good picture right there of Dr. Austin. Right there with the
what's this now?
It says bullshit right across your t-shirt. That's the take-home picture for the...
Oh, I used to, for freshman exams, I had this great shirt I liked a lot. If you can't dazzle them with brilliance, baffle them with bullshit. But then I was told by some students they did not find it appropriate. Yet another letter from the dean, and I don't wear it anymore. I just tell you how hard, unfortunately you can't see this here. This is at this RAB37 gene. There was two of them right next to it. These are calls. That's the mutation right there. You can see it. It's on every place. It's got to be 100%. And the coverage here keeps on going down. This is the wild type here. You don't really see anything here. This is the sequencing noise. This guy here we didn't call. It looks like there might be one there, but you see that it missed there. It doesn't have the coverage that these two have, right? Didn't call it. Could be a SNP, but we're not calling it. Just to let you know, I'm trying to be honest. Are these mutations interesting? Right, that's the question. Are they interesting or not? The answer is yes. So what about this RAB2737? That's where that location is. Right, go Google it up. It's part of RAS. It's part of the rat sarcoma gene, superfamily. So this RAB is a family of proteins that are important in regulating signal transduction, differentiation, proliferation, assembly, cytoskeleton formation, and it's known to be necessary for the adhesion and migration of cancer cells. Ta-da! Makes sense. Although RAS and RHO have been strongly implicated in cancer progression, knowledge of RABs, that's us, action in this regard is limited. Some reports have also linked RAB GTPases with cancer cell migration and invasiveness. So, that's cool. It looks like those two makes sense, whatever that means. What about ZEB2? It promotes the metastasis of gastric cancer. It's known to do that. Overexpression of ZEB2 at the invasion from colorectal cancer, Daryl, is an important prognostic marker and regulates tumor invasion in vitro. It upregulates, in a way, so we know a lot about it. It induces invasion during epithelial, the mesenchymal transition of human, that's metastasis. It's a precursor to metastasis. So of the five, three right now are clearly connected with metastasis, I would say. Let's see the next one, AGSK1, what is that? It is a sarcoma-associated one again. It's an antigen. It seems to show up. It's a potential target for cancer vaccines, by the way. It's metabolized and expressed in highly invasive cancer cells. So 4 out of 5 show metastasis capabilities. I don't know what this guy here is, really. It's known, you can buy it, but I can't figure it. It has something to do with Alzheimer's, actually, which I don't understand. But anyways, it may be a red herring here. But that, this of the 5, 4 of them are clearly connected with invasiveness and metastasis. So my theory is now is that we've evolved we started out with a resistant cancer cell. We did chemo on it, and we did our thing. And what we evolved in a couple weeks was a metastatic cancer cell. That's my theory right now. That we've evolved metastasis there. We've gone from a tumorigenic to a metastatic cell. At least just looking at the SNPs that you see, but don't bank on this. Don't go to your doctor and say that this is the way to believe it. I'm
just
as honest as I can be.
Say again? If one takes 5 random annotated proteins.
I'm sorry, Boris.
Just as due diligence, can one do a control, take 5 random proteins that are annotated and make up a story of how...
You can, Boris. You're a genius. You can do that. There's lots of oncogenes and associated things, and I'm guessing out of 1 out of 5, you're going to have exactly that. And you're right. And I mean, remember, I lost my bullshit. John says it's all bullshit, by the way.
It could be that
this is just a random throw of the dice, and it has happened to land on these particular invasive. I don't know.
Right, that's what the p-values are for, right?
P-values
for
these.
Sample quintuplets. And,
how do you got to calculate it? All these p-values here. These are all 20-fold deep, right? The p-values here are vanishingly small on every one of them, right?
No. P-values on the story about the.
Oh, p-value on the story. I see. The p-value on the call is very good. You're wondering. Oh, that's a great question.
I'm just concerned.
I like that. I'm not quite sure how to do that kind of a p-value analysis. It's a great question. No, I love it. You're right. Right. Very good.
But can I ask actually another question?
Sure.
Trying to make sense of the numbers.
Yeah.
So how much sequence did you actually sequence?
So these are all the, this is all cDNA, right? So it's like around 5% of the total genome has been sequenced.
5%. Okay, so we sort of know that 2 random individuals have in the whole genome 1 million SNPs, right? So
what does that mean? What does that mean?
I thought that sort of the genetic distance between any pair of us is
I don't know what to say here.
Million.
I don't know. I don't know, Boris. I mean, when we compare these things, that sounds too high to me.
Two million.
Where'd you get that number from?
1 to 3, order of magnitude.
We're getting thousands, Boris.
And that's precisely why I'm asking. It looks low to me.
It looks low to you.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I got confused.
Oh, yeah. But well, wait a minute.
So if you're comparing to the human genome.
Right.
This is
cDNA. Right, we're only looking at the messenger RNA. We're sequencing messenger RNA, and I think this number throws out all low coverage. We just don't even talk about low coverage. Okay. And the coverage, as I said, has got a lot of variance in it.
Okay. Very
so if I just right, okay, Boris. So this number will definitely rise if I could have uniformly high coverage, I would guess, on everything.
Okay. So that makes sense.
Right. So and these are tough. It's hard. We're doing the best we can.
So what do you mean you evolved resistance?
It grows at 20 times the doxorubicin it started with.
So is this
Lurie
Delper
resurrected? No, Jesus. I mean, so there's mutations going on, right?
But if you show some of your data, some of those mutants were in the wild type.
That's what Boris has tried. He would expect actually millions, right? The human genome accession 37 is just an average number. But I think Boris, who presumably is very healthy, and I did it, I'm guessing that it would look, you know, something like this too. Boris doesn't have cancer, but he would have, you know.
How do you know that you don't have an existing variant that you just selected for?
I don't know. Of course I don't know.
So this is Laurie and Dalberg again.
I don't care about Laurie Dalberg, by the way. I don't want to. I mean, for the bacteria, I drove it through his heart, and that was. I'm done with Laurie Dalberg. All right. All I'm saying is here that you're seeing here the another 1,300 SNPs appearing in this line, which was grown and under high stress mutagenic conditions.
But if you go forward one slide.
Is that forward or backwards?
No, I guess back.
We go past the cartoon,
the
right?
Sequencing, where you were showing all this, the sequencing.
What did I do?
Keep going.
I don't think I did yet. I didn't get to that yet. Where did I?
Here.
Oh, here, okay.
See, I see some T's in the...
Of course you do, right, yeah. But that's sequencing noise, right?
No.
It's 1%. That's typical aluminum noise.
Is that in the wild type?
It's all. Are you looking at these guys right here?
Uh-huh.
Sure. I guess I've managed to pick a place. You'd expect to see some popping around here. I don't know why this particular one is. Sure. I would assume is a sequencing noise. 1%. 1% of the calls are typically wrong.
So but the bottom one is wild type, right?
This is wild type. This is the evolved, and I've zoomed in on a SNP call.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see key there.
Oh, I mean, yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, A, there's noise in the system. I mean, the machine makes 1% errors. So you expect every out of every 100 base pairs, it's going to make a mistake.
So it'd be one out of 100 of those. And I see 4 out of...
Oh, but you see a lot here, but you got to go this way, right?
Wouldn't they go down that way for each base?
Well, this is a little bit funny here. What you're saying is there's sort of like a normally high number of T's here, right? And that's...
Well, yeah, it's...
You're right. But yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. It's funny. I don't know what to say.
Okay, well, that's...
I don't know what to say, yeah.
That's the substrate of...
Yeah, I don't know what to say here, but that's the data. That's what it is.
I think
it's certainly this guy's here. I don't know why... This is pretty clean. I'm a little bit puzzled why there's... I don't see more... Why don't see some more popping up here? I don't know. I think it's just the luck of the draw the way it is. But I don't know.
If you go back to that, you know, with the multi-drug resistance,
right,
there could be variations in the level of control that you might...
Of course. Oh, I do. Yeah.
I think in that sense, it's no Gloria.
Oh, God, I cannot put the stake to the heart of Delbert Gloria. I cannot do it with the biologist. It's impossible.
Your experiments are telling us that is what's going on.
Say again?
Your experiments are telling us that is... I mean, I don't see any evidence that you actually have to know what we're doing.
You're seeing mutations, right?
Yeah, I see.
You're seeing mutations that were not... You're seeing mutations that were not present in the wild type. That's all I have to say. If that mutation was there, it would be here too.
But you may not be covering it. So I think...
Yeah, you could. I really don't know whether it's worth worrying about that. I mean, you can... Where's an example of... What was I trying to show you here? I mean... See these red dots here? These are SNPs that occur in both of them at the same place. This is a pre-existing mutation that's also present in the evolved one. Okay? They're present in both. That's all these red dots. All the blue circles, there's no overlap.
Yeah, but pre-existing mutations in certain genes.
They still should show up here and here. If my sequencing technology is working well, you know, if they're pre-existing and I did everything right, hey, and there are pre-existing ones that do show up. I mean, they're there, don't get me wrong. But I'm telling you, this all this blue stuff here wasn't there before. Right? There's 1,300 new SNPs here that weren't here. And there's 1,000 some that are here that are not in human genome at session 37. Okay? So you're seeing a doubling of the SNPs, if you want to call it that way, whatever ones you want to believe are real or not, in the mutants.
So is there another cell line of bone myelin you could do these?
There are multiple, yeah, there are multiple.
Because it's like, you know, you're looking for the Higgs boson and they're showing bumps in the same place.
Yeah, I don't believe the Higgs boson either. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, David isn't here. Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you find the same, the same SNPs in both, as the difference between A and mutated A, you know.
Of course, but a different cell line would have a different phenotype, and I'm quite sure the SNP pattern will be different, by the way. We know that happens in the bacteria, by the way. If I give a different strain of bacteria and do my other experiment,
but this is the same tissue.
We get SNPs. What do you want me to do?
No,
this is a primary. This is a cell line, but it's not primary.
If you back through the SNPs that you found your five SNPs that are you think are significant.
Yeah.
If those same five SNPs show up as a difference in a different cell line.
Yeah, but they won't, by the way. But I think they'll be in related areas, though. But it won't be in the same position, is my prediction. I know that from the bacteria, that's true.
So you can partition your SNPs between synonymous and non-synonymous here, right?
Oh, God, we're going to talk about synonymous mutations.
I mean, so if you want to think about
it. You guys know what that's all about? That's pretty interesting, yeah. Why do you want to do that?
If you're making a biological story.
Yeah, I just started doing this. I'm on a very steep learning curve here. So I'm not very sophisticated yet.
It's a way of determining where the most of the mutations are selected for or not selected for.
So a synonymous mutation, if I'm not mistaken, codes for the same amino acid.
Correct.
Right. Which, by the way, does change, you know that, right? It changes the activity of the protein. Synonymous mutations give rise to proteins of different activity. You know that?
No.
No, they give rise to different.
Did you know that?
They give rise to different.
It's true.
Different
synonymous ones can have different activity.
Activity in the sense of protein abundance being changed, right?
Because they fold differently.
Yeah.
There's a lot of literature on this. That's why these guys. What I'm really being interested in looking for is at the looking at the.
It changes how tRNAs are bound, right? Are your tRNA
No, this is not me making this up. It shocked me when I saw this. Synonymous mutations give rise to different activities in vivo by large amounts. So it's because the folding changes it doesn't fold at the same rate, even though it's a synonymous mutation. Gives rise to a misfolded protein. People believe that. We know that the chaperones are very important, by the way, for cancer cells. There's probably a lot of misfolded protein.
Let's not go that way.
I'm sorry, Boris. What's that?
Let's not go that way. Let's skip to the next slide.
All right. Sorry, yeah. I just thought I'll shut up. I'm really done. I am done. Did I yell at Daryl? Let's see. Right? Lots of fun. So I'm trying to tell you that we're killing people, in my opinion. We're making them live longer. It's great. But the mortality rates have been high. And basically, the beatings will continue until the patient improves, is what's happening right now. It's a dead horse. I just thought I am working on metastasis, by the way. But I don't have time to talk to you, but I just want to point this out. This is 5% of cancer research funds are spent on metastasis, yet it kills 90% of all cancer patients. So this mutations and the way the system progresses, this is all very important. Resistance is important. But what really is killing us actually is metastasis. So, and this is actually in Europe. I mean, Europeans drive small cars, take trains, and have health care. And yet they can't figure it out either, that they're putting their money in the wrong place, I would guess. We should really be concentrating on metastasis in our research programs, and we're not. I think these cells are metastatic, by the way, but I haven't proved it to you other than the way the gene pattern looks in the thing. So anyways, that's something I think that we've been ignoring this sort of thing. So I think we might be doing the right thing here, sort of inadvertently. Maybe I've stumbled upon learning how to drive normal cancer cells through the metastatic transition through stress gradients created by chemotherapy. Final end movement cancers game to kill the hosts. which we've been aiding in our paradigm. So just as we won't fund the obvious ways to prevent cancer, we're not going to do it at no cost. Actually, we'd make money off it. We won't support research on what really kills us, metastasis. That would make too much sense. So with that, we are all prisoners here of our own device. And it's kind of a grim scene, so I've gotten depressed about what's going on in the cancer community. Thank you. That's it.
Bob, you might want to say a little bit about what you're doing with metastasis.
Yeah, metastasis. We're doing 3D experiments now where we, you guys know the Tour de France is in progress right now. And if you follow Tour de France racers, right? Mm. What do they do? You guys know the
platoon?
The platoon. What they mean, English people call it peloton. You know what that is? It's this clump of racers, you know. And so if you're in the lead of the platoon, you know, you're wearing not the yellow jersey, by the way. Why would you do that? You take all the drag. The guys in back get a free ride, right? 40% of the work is done on hydrodynamic drag in racing. So what they do is the teams rotate around. It's actually a very dynamic thing. The platoon is dynamic. The leaders exchange positions with it, and then at the final end game, somebody tries to spurt out at the end. But they have this game theory going on during the race. So we are launching metastatic cells. We have metastatic prostate cancer cell line, which is going through collagen, and we have 3D imaging, and we can have little marker beads. We can look at the hydrodynamic drag, if you will, that the cells have to expend as they invade, and we can track all the cells using 3D confocal imaging, and we actually see this exchange of leaders. So they act in a cooperative way. It is not a random walk. It's not that. We see exchange every 1 to 2 days of the leader as they go through the thing. So we think we see the emergence of cooperativity there. In other words, metastasis is not just cells gone wild. They are acting as a community with a overall fitness, and they're probably acting like the bicycle racers in the Tour de France, exchanging the leader with the thing. And so we're looking at these strategies that the cancer cells show as they move through 3D space.
Do they do that because they learn or because of physics?
Say again?
Do they do that because they learn to interact with
I don't know. You have to ask them.
Physics? Because fish, they do similar things.
Yeah, of course. Like the Ian Cousins, there's a lot of it's a flocking phenomena, and whether or not it's a learned response, I don't know. You know, some of us think that these cells are quite intelligent, actually, but that's again heretical. It makes the biologists even more upset. But I think they know what they're doing. Anyways, that's reclaiming this work we're doing now. The analysis is tricky because it could be just random walkers. Of course, you'll have guys coming and going, right? So how do you do the statistical analysis on that and really be sure you got a Tour de France kind of thing happening?
Well, a number of us have been looking at this for some years.
Uh-huh, right.
And we've been emphasizing the fact that the cells remodel the collagen.
Yep.
And make highways.
Absolutely, right.
This is something well known to tissue injury.
Right, right. Yep.
So it could be that, in fact, there's no direct communication between the cells, but they're simply going via the collagen highways.
Right, but the question is, once you're in the lead, do you stay in the lead or not? And so we were saying that's not true, that they exchange. But in our collagen, we have an invading front, so they don't finger. There's no finger. It's a lot different than the neoblastomas, I think. We don't see a fingering instability going on. We're just sort of a front going down, looks like that. I'm sorry to have time to talk about it today. It's very interesting stuff. Yeah.
So the effect you're quantifying on the fact that you're inducing resistance and inducing metastasis.
Right.
If it seems like a huge effect, but so you should be able to reconstruct historical data and to prove that with the beginning of the chemotherapy, you should get huge historical bumps of metastasis.
Uh-huh.
Because we have data at the time of radical mastectomies on the occurrence of metastasis. So you should see, if it's true, you should see huge historical bumps increasing metastasis, right?
Right. If I claim that chemotherapy has had a negative influence, right, then right, and I don't think you see that. I think you sort of see a sort of no change. But I don't. It's a good question. But I don't have to say. I think when they do studies, though, I think if they actually see something going the wrong way, they simply terminate the study. And so they might self-censor those things. Is that possible? It could be a self-censored data set. I don't know. I don't know. We know that radical mastectomies were a failure because of metastasis.
Yeah, no, but from that we get data. Yeah, we have approximately.
So they stopped doing radical mastectomies now.
I think we take the last question and go to cookies.
I had a question about the bacterial experiment.
Okay, well, really?
Is there an
analog? It's not Delbert Gloria, is it?
I'm going to fight the war. Okay, great. Semantics. All I wanted to say is that is there an analog of that experiment in test tube? So you see that in this particular version, you don't see any passenger mutations, you don't see anything which you expect.
Richard Lenski's been doing this for 25 years in test tubes.
And but antibiotic is this particular experiment.
There's a chemosat experiment that was done at Harvard by, what's his name, pretty recently. He's a well-known guy. What they did was they slowly ramped up in a chemostat. It wasn't Cipro, it was something else. So what they would do is they would model in the optical density of the chemostat and slowly step it and wait till they see it. Then they would do that. And they got resistance in about 2 weeks. They had a feedback system to look for the incipient changes in a Wellmark's thing, and when they would see that some resistance was emerging, they would up it, slowly up it. So that's a well-mixed system with a feedback, and in 2 weeks, I forget the name of the guys at Harvard, they saw that. It was a paper in Nature. It's very interesting, right? So they did see the, of course you will, and they had feedback going on. We just do it faster, I would say, because they had a large number. It's not that it can't happen, of course. I mean, most antibiotics fail right now.
Okay, let's not go. Thanks.